You're listening to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. My name is Jessica Dubois.
And I'm Derek Wynn. Here, we chronicle the stories of successful business owners and executives who stand out from the crowd.
Whether you're driven by purpose or profit, tune in to learn how these leaders have built successful businesses,
helping to shape the landscape of Northern Virginia.
I probably moved around 6 or 7 times over that time span. And the best way to put it is I think I just have a diversity of lived experiences, both during that portion of my life as well as since then. So being born in the UK, originally from Malaysia, of Indian ancestry and ethnicity, and being part of a military family, just had us moving around, and therefore being able to adapt quickly, being able to understand different populations and understand both how to assimilate as well as how to maintain one's own cultural integrity were all different facets of my early life and have probably formed and shaped who I am today.
No, I can imagine so. And what moved you around so much?
My dad was in the military, so that was one thing that had us moving around quite a bit. The other was his pursuit of higher education. He didn't have the opportunity to get his degree the way many of us do, you know, between the ages of 18 and 22 or 23. He had to work hard. His family didn't have the money. So once he was working, he went back to school as an adult. He got his undergraduate degree, then his master's, then his PhD. And it was his movement for education to different parts of the world. And he brought us, his family, along at the same time. So that expanded our own horizons and exposure and contributed to us being able to experience the world.
It sounds like an incredible role model too.
Absolutely. Both my parents have been incredible role models. My dad, for the reasons I just mentioned, his interest and, you know, in education, broadening of the mind, intellectual pursuit. And my mom, for her ability to just traverse her roles throughout that, because when my father was a student, we were dirt poor. We were, you know, and he had to take care of a family of 5 of us in total. And my mom took on any job she needed to help us have, you know, the food and shelter and a positive experience. So both of them have really shaped who I am today.
Did you feel like in those early years? So it sounds like, a lot of your experiences have guided you throughout your career, which we'll get into, but do you feel as if early on you got some type of inspiration of what you wanted to do for your career?
You know, I'm not sure that I can say that I got an inspiration early on, but what I did understand is that people are in certain circumstances at different points in their lives that they don't fully control. And in other instances, you choose to be in certain circumstances for a period of time because you've got a longer term vision and a goal in terms of what you're subscribing to. So as an example, you know, we were a comfortable middle class family in Malaysia with every, you know, all the trappings that come with that. And then we moved to the United States and my dad comes to do his PhD and he's on a scholarship, but we don't have any support for our own living expenses. And so my mom works at a grocery store, you know, and all of a sudden we are, you know, really tight on finances. We're getting free meals at school. We're getting support with our utilities. We're navigating that whole system. And it's uncomfortable for those few years. But we knew that my dad had his own pursuit of what he wanted to do. And he wanted us to have that exposure, you know, and understanding and education as well. And I think all of that has shaped how I see those who are in varying circumstances and what they need in terms of that enabling environment or enabling support to be able to realize their own aspirations and their own dreams.
Part of what you mentioned in that is that transformation when you come to the US. So what stands out to you as being an early memory that has stuck with you, good, bad, or indifferent from that transition in that part of your life?
Well, I'd point to two. You know, one I just mentioned earlier, which was, you know, just trying to to understand as a 13-year-old why we gave up, you know, living a comfortable life, you know, to come here to live in tight circumstances. I understood my dad wanting to get his own education and further our own, but, you know, just trying to understand that and some of the stigma that comes with free meals, you know, in high school and those types of things. So that has stayed with me for sure. The other part that is a memory from those early years when we were in the United States was we didn't expect to stay and still be here. He was coming for 3 years, you know, he was getting his education, we would get this experience and we would go back. And I'm born into a culture and a community that has fairly rigid expectations of the role of women. And so I knew that probably by the age of 18 to 20, I would, you know, have to have an arranged marriage and everything that came with that. And so for me, these 3 years in the United States at the time were, gosh, I need to maximize my education. I need to maximize everything that I can experience. And I had a goal of wanting to get to college before my parents left so that that would enable me to have a few more years and an education here. And that was what I did. And so I focused on that in school, in summer school, and got into college by age of 16, which I knew I had to do in order to continue to stay in the United States.
I was just doing the math on that, and I was going to say 16. So at 16 years old, you graduate from high school, and then talk to me about like the next year or two. Like, what? How did that all happen?
So at that point, given my parents, I think, were conflicted. They wanted to continue to abide by cultural norms and et cetera. But my dad, as I told you, is a big educationist and an intellectual. And he realized that this was an opportunity that, you know, was too good for me to give up. And so they agreed. My dad went back to Malaysia. My mom stayed with us. I commuted from home to Tufts, and they made, you know, they allowed it. And I agreed that, you know, I would try and you know, pursue this, but pursue it quickly. It felt like a race in the early stages of my life. And I wanted to get the degree now before any sort of conversations around marriage and things like that were, you know, on the table. And so I finished my undergraduate in 3 years because I knew that, you know, this was important. So sort of 18, 19, not because I was any brilliant child, but because of this race to be able to, you know, have that degree that would give me the possibilities for the future. As well.
So how did you decide to go into economics?
You know, it's interesting. I started as an engineering student, and my dad thought that would be a good field, which was interesting. I didn't have a particular interest one way or the other. So I had 4 engineering, you know, classes/math classes and 1 economics class. I did abysmally in the other 4, and I did really well in economics. And so I said, okay, this might be an indication of where my true interest lies. And that's why I decided to pursue economics.
I'm still sitting here, and I have to admit, I'm amazed. You know, you just told us about how you went through more in the course of 6 years than I know people it took them 7 years just to get through college, which I think is interesting. But you also did it because you had just this set goal. You said, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and this is why I'm going to do that. So is that something that you continue to repeat throughout the rest of your life, even today? Like, are you still kind of like sitting there as your 13-year-old self saying, hey, I have this goal or vision. I need to be there in the next 3 years. If I don't get there, blank. Is that
it's
still
very interesting that you draw that conclusion, because I think it's really accurate. It took me a little while to understand that about myself. But yes, I am very goal driven. I do think ahead. I think the other thing that I learned from that young sort of teenage years, if you will, was I needed to be a few steps ahead to be able to really realize my ultimate goals or goals during that period of time. And that is something that I've taken with me to every single job that I've had, which is, what do I envision here? What do I want to accomplish? Where do I want to be, you know, a few years from now? And that notion, as I've become more senior, you know, in the various jobs and in my career, that's where I'm really comfortable thinking 3 to 5 years out, thinking about what the landscape is going to look like. What, in our case now, what's this region going to look like? You know, yes, where's the food bank today? But given where the region's and what the region's going to look like a few years from now, what role should we be playing then? So this notion of you know, developing strategies, planning for something that's 3 to 5 years out has been with me, whether I've been in the private sector and management consulting, which only further enhanced my ability to do that, you know, or in the nonprofit roles that I've had over the last 10, 15 years.
So another interesting part. So I'm curious to see, so like two things. One, do you ever feel like you missed out during those years? Like, you know, being a 13, 14 year old, 15, 16 year old girl and missing out on a lot of stuff. Do you feel like you were in that position? If so, how have you made up for that? Or is it just kind of continuing to go for these goals?
You know, it's interesting. I saw a lot, obviously, around me as a 13-year-old coming from an Asian country to a public U.S. high school. You know, I was stunned by a lot of what I saw, the freedom that kids had here versus what we had in Malaysia. But I also saw so many of the insecurities, the challenges, et cetera. So I'm not really sure that I missed all that much in that period of time. And I was still very, and I still am, you know, culturally, you know, I think I've expanded my horizons, but I was very true to the culture that, you know, I was born into and grew up in, and so didn't feel like I actually was missing a whole lot, you know, during that time. I think I've grown, and, you know, being in the United States continues to expose you to so many different cultures, and I think as I've become more mature and more confident, I've actually enjoyed what I've had around me now more so than missed what I had, you know, in those teenage years.
When you were a step ahead from the people around you in many different ways. Like I think of intellectually, the experiences, your maturity, but I also think about the challenges you probably had as an immigrant, as a woman. I mean, tell me about some of these. Did you start to notice that when you were in college?
Yes and no. So I did notice some of it in college in the sense of just being... I'm not sure if sidelined is the right word, but having greater affinity or being more accepted amongst the international students, you know, students of color versus sort of mainstream, if you will. But I think it was also less that there was any discrimination, but more that I wasn't just as acclimatized or familiar with how to engage, you know, with the broader set of students within the university. But I think, you know, over time, I've benefited significantly from both having a clear goal so I could let some of these other pieces fade into the background, if you will, but also strong mentors, you know, those who've supported me from all the way from professors in college and in graduate school to peers, as well as, you know, supervisors who've helped pave the way. And I've benefited not just from, you know, primarily from women mentors, I would say, but broadly from others as well.
When you make me think of but bringing up mentors, so I want to talk a little bit about that, because I had to put together this presentation for Career Day back for some students for some schools in rural Iowa. And one of the main points that I talked about was this magic that happens when you have someone who is open-minded, hardworking, has this willingness to learn and to work. And then the magic that happens when you connect that with mentors and leaders who believe in them and inspire them. And so tell me about the mentors that you had. Where did you find them? How did they lead you forward?
You know, I would point to a couple different examples. When I was at Tufts, you know, I had several professors in the economics department in particular, who were not only guiding me from an academic perspective, but who truly understood and helped me navigate, make my own choices, but helped me understand the possibilities if I chose to divert from the path that I was born into. You know, I mentioned earlier having to have an arranged marriage was the expectation, you know, right around 18 or 19. And it was clear to me at that age that that wasn't the path any longer that I wanted to go down. But I felt really trapped between parents that had supported one part of my ambition and expected, you know, me to go back and assimilate back into my culture. And it was too difficult for me to do that, too hard to go against them. And I needed others who to gently but supportively also suggest that there are other pathways. You know, I wouldn't be breaking away from tradition forever, and that I would be able to, you know, accomplish what I wanted to and maybe go back in a different way, you know, down the road. So those professors didn't just help me with, you know, what courses to take to get my degree, but really helped me understood and be confident that I could have a life, you know, in the United States that was different from what I had, you know, been brought up to expect. Then I think the other part is when I, you know, went into management consulting, there were several, again, women partners there who really understood what I was trying to do. Because I went into management consulting to really understand different industries, to be able to really understand the workings of the corporate and private world, so that I could bring together the private, the public, and the nonprofit sectors towards social impact. By that point in my life, I knew that's what I wanted to do. I had some experience in the nonprofit side. I wanted to understand what made corporate America tick, you know, and was it different from industry to industry? How do they view engagement of the, you know, populations in the developing world? I needed to understand that side before being able to come back into the nonprofit world and thread these really interesting public-private partnerships to support those who are most unfortunate. So I had mentors there who, you know, helped me learn, helped me succeed, pointed me, you know, to some projects and clients that would help me gain what I needed to.
It's funny. I also mentioned or noticed that trend, you know, you go private, you know, public, et cetera, you know, throughout your career. So what finally led you to where you are today? You know, I see this long heritage of, you know, organizations to support others. How did you end up at Capital Area Food Bank?
When I was at the Council on Foreign Relations, this was in the early 90s, I joined the council because I was interested in foreign policy and economic policy in particular, thinking that those who really helped craft what that would be in the academic and government, you know, arenas. And the Council on Foreign Relations was a great place to be able to learn and have that exposure. What I didn't count on was understanding the role that the private sector played. I was at the council in New York. Most of the members actually there were from the private sector, you know, financial industry, et cetera. And it opened my eyes to the role that companies could play, not that they were necessarily playing in the 90s, but could play. And that was the beginning of a whole range of corporate social responsibility efforts. And even beyond that, sort of looking at supply chains of companies and how, you know, if they were, well-structured, could not only enhance the company's bottom line, but really lift up millions, you know, out of poverty around the world. So that was so intriguing. And the light bulb went off there that this is what I want to do. And I realized sitting with a master's in economics at that point that, you know, I needed to understand more about this private sector, you know, in quotes. And so that was my transition to business school and then into management consulting and then understanding that and then coming back into the mission-oriented space. So I was with the Red Cross for a few years, really enjoyed that. And it helped me transition back into the mission-oriented space, but realized then and at that point in my life that I wanted to not just be with an American nonprofit, but really be applying these principles of public-private partnership in the developing world. And that's when I joined CARE and worked with CARE for, you know, almost 7 years, both in India as well as with CARE in a public-private partnerships realm. So all of those things came together. I worked with the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves, which is going from a, you know, big nonprofit CARE to a startup that was taking a market-based approach to address social problems. And as I spent my 7 years there flying out of DC continuously, you know, for work all around the world, beginning to realize more and more that poverty was right here in our own backyard. Issues of, you know, the divide between those who were wealthy and those who had almost nothing was growing in our backyard, and realizing that I now had a toolkit that had a lot of different elements within it that could be put to work here in the community that had given me so much, and I wanted to now give back. And so that is what made me realize that I wanted to work regionally and locally. And, you know, I believe that you put something out into the universe and it responds. And as I was thinking about what could I do here, the position at the Capital Area Food Bank opened up. And I've been here now, you know, coming up on 3 years.
Well, you sure did pick a great third year, because I'm sure that, you know, with your long history of having 3 to 5 year plans, you probably had other plans for 2020 than what actually has transpired. So talk to us a little bit, if you could, because, you know, you go through your resume, you've had experience working with social issues, you've had experience working with economic issues. Tell us what working through 2020 has been like for you in Capital Area Food Bank.
Well, for me personally, 2020 has just highlighted how all the different facets of my career are, you know, all those tools that I've developed at different points are being put to work right now, you know, from the social impact issues to how do you respond when there's a tremendous increase in demand for the service that you're providing? How do you restructure and pivot your operations and supply chain to be able to meet that demand? How do you have a completely different financial balance sheet and income statement, you know, and ensure that you have sufficient revenue to be able to meet this growing need? All of those different pieces have come to play this particular year. Now, for the Capital Area Food Bank, we've been servicing this region for 40 years now. You know, this was meant to be our 40th year of commemorating, celebrating, you know, working together with the community. And we had envisioned it in a different way, I will say that. But boy, what a year to be able to commemorate the need and the partnerships in the region, because it's there's been no other year where we've been called upon to do as much as we have needed to do in partnership and by ourselves, you know, for our community. So for the Capital Area Food Bank, this has just been a tremendous year of having to pivot from an operational perspective, you know, having to manage with physical distancing requirements when typically we work so closely with all of our clients and partners, from a year of being able to reorient our transportation and fleet to become a delivery-only program, when before we've had many partners, you know, come to the food bank to get what they need to support their communities. And a year where we have literally doubled, and in some cases more than doubled, the budget requirements to be able to meet the need in our community, which has gone from, you know, 400,000 food insecure people in the greater Washington region just in 8 months to about 600,000 food insecure people. So it's been a year of tremendous change, where we've had to pivot our models every few months to be able to respond to the needs and to the health concerns around the pandemic as well.
Well, I think we often forget that for millions of Americans, the biggest challenge they've had is turning on or off their camera for Zoom, or turning on or off their mute button. And people are dealing with much bigger issues out there, right? Due to everything we're seeing right now. Can you give us a sense in just kind of where you are today compared to maybe what you had planned for? And where are you at according to plan in terms of supply, demand, et cetera? Like, are you, for example, I know that on your website, you have a heat map to show kind of where the need areas are. Are you running, you know, at a critical deficit right now based on the increased demand? Kind of tell us a little bit more about where you are.
Let me throw out a few statistics for you to understand how we were operating pre-COVID and how we're operating now. So our plan for the year pre-COVID was to distribute enough food for the equivalent of about 30 million meals in the community. Right now, our plan is to provide enough food to provide the equivalent of 50 million meals in the community. Before COVID hit, two-thirds of the food that we distribute was donated to us from area retailers. And the rest of it was either U.S. government food or food that we purchased. Now we flip that completely around, and two-thirds of the food that we're distributing, we're purchasing with donations of food, you know, at dramatically low levels, because there's not enough for retailers to be able to donate to us, with all of us carrying our own pantries in our own homes, if you will, for several weeks, you know, worth of supply. The other is we didn't used to provide boxed food. food before COVID, because we believe in a client choice models. We want, you know, clients to come shop at, you know, areas that look like farmers markets, you know, except they're getting the food for free, for us to have conversations, to talk about the benefits of good, healthy eating, to share recipes and recipe cards of how to eat on a budget, those types of things. All of that has changed. We're not having those in-person conversations any longer. Instead, we're providing, you know, about 70 to 80,000 boxes of food, you know, to individuals each month. So that's not on an annual basis by any means, but each month. So lots of things have changed in that sense. We have, you know, we've always benefited from having volunteers help us with our work. We now have to have volunteers, you know, 6 feet apart in our warehouse, you know, and we have to be thinking carefully about how volunteers and our staff engage in public as we provide food to individuals. So lots of changes in terms of how we work. Our community has been incredibly generous in supporting us with financial resources, and we are so thankful for that, primarily because we're purchasing so much more of what's being distributed to now 600,000 individuals. We don't see this as just a short sprint. You know, in April or May, if we'd had this conversation, you know, I would have said, well, it looks like we're going to see a significant uptake for a few months, you know, but now we know better, and we know that this significant uptake is likely to be a marathon level engagement as opposed to, you know, a short sprint like engagement. So we're in this, unfortunately, for a couple, you know, at least a couple years, if not more to come. And so we need to partner together, whether you're a company, you're a CEO of a company, you're a student, you know, you're someone in need, you know, we are all going to have to come together to put forward our best assets and resources in collaboration to help our neighbors who, you know, many of whom are first time food insecure, to help them with their current circumstances and to help them in the recovery process well.
Ask you about some of the myths people have around food insecurity. So I know many people might have their own perception or assumptions that they have around people who would be food insecure. But what are some things that we're missing?
I think, you know, everyone has their myths, but I think the reality is that there, you know, there isn't a single zip code in our relatively wealthy region that doesn't have, you know, thousands of food insecure individuals within it. So people sometimes think that, oh, well, we've got Montgomery County and Fairfax County. These are the wealthiest counties in the country. You know, surely food insecurity doesn't exist there. Absolutely, it exists and exists now in larger numbers as a result of the unemployment that has occurred. I think another myth, which isn't true, is that most people who are food insecure don't have jobs, aren't working, you know, sort of sitting back and getting their food stamps and, you know, and other public support. That couldn't be further from the truth. Most of the individuals who we work with and provide food to are not just working one job, they're working multiple jobs. It's just that they're multiple jobs that are often minimum wage jobs. And in our area where the cost of living is only going up every single year, they're finding it hard to be able to make ends meet, put food on the table, and have a roof over their heads at the same time. Very few, I would say, you know, it's 5% or less of those who we work with are actually not actively looking for work or not working at this point in time.
So I would think to really create lasting change, we really have to target some, I mean, especially those people who I think about don't have jobs or people who have jobs but need to build their skills. And I know that that's a program that you all do, is helping people build skills needed to be able to pay for themselves, to be able to grow and prosper. Now, tell me more about, like, how do we combine the efforts between federal, private, corporate partnerships in order to help move this initiative forward?
You know, we as a food bank are here to provide food to those who are hungry today, but we don't want to stop just there. We want food, along with other basic support services, to be an enabler so that people can transition from the unfortunate circumstances that they find themselves today to better circumstances, financially sustainable circumstances for themselves and for their families. And we know that food has tremendous power. It has the power to draw individuals, to convene individuals. So what we've been working on, along with colleges, skill development institutes, healthcare facilities, is to ensure that we can provide food to those who are trying to enhance their circumstances in life. So as an example, we see about 50% of the students who are enrolled in programs in community colleges in our area are actually adults with families who are working. They're not in that 18 to 21 year old age range, if you will. Many of them are trying to improve their skills so that they can get living wage and higher wage jobs. And by having food available there, it's an incentive to keep people in those programs because they don't have to worry about how they're going to put food on the table for their families. And so that can keep someone in a program and allow them to graduate to have higher earning jobs. The other thing that we're seeing is so many in our community either don't have insurance or feel that wellness care is going to be an expensive proposition, and they don't feel they can take the scarce resources and dollars that they have and allocate it towards that. And yet they know that wellness care is important. It can prevent, future disastrous, potentially health outcomes. It's just they don't have a real choice to be able to do that. So we're trying to make that decision a little bit easier for individuals. For example, if a woman is pregnant, she should go for all of her prenatal checks. And so we want to be able to provide 20 to 30 pounds of healthy groceries at the point of that prenatal check and during each prenatal check, and to support her with a ride to get to that prenatal check, because we know transportation can be a barrier. If you think about two buses and a metro to get someplace and it takes you half a day, that will put anyone off, in terms of being able to go get that service. So between our partnerships with rideshare providers and our partnerships with medical facilities and healthcare providers, we can use food and those partnerships to make it that much easier for a person to, in this case, an example, a pregnant woman, to get the care that she needs. So it's that type of example where, a combination of what the federal government can do in terms of expansion of the food stamp program, expansion and easing of eligibility criteria for the WIC program, Women, Infant, and Children program. All of these things are incredible programs that have long-lasting impact. So that's the role the federal government can play. We can play that supplementary role, that helps them for those last few days a month when those programs have expired, to be able to, yes, provide them with additional healthy food, but also to have that be available so that there's one trip where they're going to get their skill development, they're getting the food at the same time. It's only one trip there and it doesn't come at a huge opportunity cost of their time. This is how all of us in our community, public, private, and nonprofit, can come together to support those who are more vulnerable at this particular time.
I feel like we could sit here and talk all day just on this topic. There's so many different crossroads. For example, transportation issues are the number one cause of missed doctor's appointments, right? You go back to season one, we actually interviewed Joe Meyer from Shelter House, where it requires $74,000 a year for a single family to afford a two-bedroom apartment in this area, right? So you've got huge issues in terms of transportation that ties to healthcare along with food. And then at the same time, you're trying to put a roof over your head, right? 32% of Americans are running out of money before the next paycheck arrives, right? There's all these different things that kind of come full circle here. And I again, kind of come back to where we are today here in Northern Virginia, right? Northern Virginia, we do have a good kind of backstop, I'll call it, in terms of one, good paying jobs, two, a lot of IT jobs. So they're largely non-disrupted. You've got the federal government as a backstop. So how do we help people to kind of, over the next couple of years, what's your future state vision for where we are today? And how do we get to that next level to make sure that even if something like this did happen again, we don't deal with the same issues twice?
Sure. So I'll answer that in a few different ways. One is that we have this region, Northern Virginia and the greater Washington region at large, have clear goals as to what we aspire to be as a community, and as a region. And we're seeing much of that come together in terms of companies that are relocating here, companies that are expanding here, and individuals who are seeking, to be a part of the growth that's occurring in this region. You speak speak to any CEO in our region and you ask them to list kind of what are their top three challenges, I guarantee you one of the three is going to be enough of an educated, skilled workforce to help fuel their company's growth and their region's growth. That is a challenge, especially with cost of living being so high in this region. So often it's the more junior entry-level positions that they're being challenged with filling as opposed to the more senior positions. My answer to that and the Capital Area Food Bank's answer to that is we actually don't have a problem. We need to work together to be able to lift up those who are seeking those positions, but there's this gap between where they are and the positions that are available at this point. So if we work together, we're able to fulfill that pipeline because we as a food bank are working with 600,000 individuals who aspire to those jobs, who want to be able to cross the chasm, so to speak, to get there. So we can help them with food, with other basic support services, education, healthcare, so that they're productive and they're contributing. And that is, so that's something that we can absolutely do in our region, and we'll need to do that together. And as a food bank, ultimately, that's our goal over the next few years, to be able to have fewer individuals who find it necessary to be dependent on us and the Emergency Food Assistance Network. We'll always be there for those who need it, but we're hoping to be there for fewer individuals because we've helped facilitate individuals into greater financial sustainability.
Well, it's interesting. So Victor Hoskins was on season two, episode one, and he said the biggest issue with getting there is that it can absolutely be done, but it's a scalability issue in that there is not a consistent source of, let's just say, federal backing or federal support toward these programs to help close skills gaps and help to elevate people. So where do we stand right now in the political environment? What kind of an impact do you think that will have on Capital Area Food Bank? And are you optimistic about the potential for federal programs to kind of help merge, again, the public private sectors to be able to help people with these skills to get to the next level? Do you think that will be something in maybe your next 3 to 5 year plan?
We believe strongly in the role that the federal government has to play to support our residents who are most in need. We are exclusively focused on food security and helping to bundle food with other support services that will allow our clients, you know, and those who are most in need, be able to travel their own pathways towards sustainability. Any federal government administration, I think, has the ability to work closely with public, other public as well as private and nonprofit actors. And we are certainly open to that type of collaboration as we move forward, because it will take various different actors. There's a role that only the public sector can play. There's a role that, you know, private actors are better suited to playing. And there's the glue that the nonprofit community can bring to the table in terms of trust in these communities to be able to tie all of these pieces together. So we are looking forward to continuing to play that role and to advocate for private as well as public actors to play the role that they're best suited to in order to ensure that our now 600,000 food insecure individuals have much better lives and prospects, and that when we speak 3 to 5 years from now, that number can be far lower than what it is at present.
I want to look into the short-term future, hopefully, here. After the pandemic, what are we looking at to rebuild our community after this pandemic?
I'm so glad you asked that question. You know, we've already started with what we need to do there. I think there are a few very concrete things. Number one, we have to realize that it may have only taken us, 8 months to go from 400,000 food insecure to 600,000. But the reverse is going to take far longer than 8 months. That's just naturally how things work, looking at industries that will recover, and those industries that our clients are a part of might take longer to recover. So that is something that people have to, keep in mind and not assume that things will return back to the way they were as quickly for those most vulnerable within our community. Knowing that, I think there are a few important things we can do. One, there are many conversations that are taking place right now about how to prioritize growth in our region. Organizations like the Capital Area Food Bank that represent the voice voice of so many who are unheard need to be at those tables. We are inserting ourselves into conversations that the Board of Trade has, you know, that other private sector actors are engaging in. If we want a region where we're growing much more holistically, comprehensively, inclusively, where everyone has a chance to play a role and can contribute to that growth, it's important for at all the boardroom tables, you know, where this discussion is taking place, look around that table and think, do I actually have every, you know, group represented here? Who am I missing? And who do I need to bring and have forward at that table? That is critical as well, if we are to have a recovery that is inclusive. The third thing is to look at, you know, what types of stimulus are still necessary in order to support and ensure that we don't leave segments of the population too far behind, that it is too difficult to be able to integrate them back into the recovery that's taking place. So this gets to, you know, businesses as well as nonprofits advocating for further support as we look at how we can recover and rebuild our region.
I really love the message that you give in that second point too, around diversity, making sure that we're inclusive. I feel like one silver lining out of this pandemic has been a more larger self-awareness around this issue. And I can see that that's an initiative for you all as well.
It's really important. You know, I think what this pandemic has shown us is the disproportionate effect on certain members of our society versus others. I think during the course of the pandemic, we also saw, you know, various racial protests, et cetera, you know, around the country and definitely in our region. There are individuals who've been trying for some time now to be able to play their role, be a part of things instead of being left behind. And, you know, you're right. The silver lining here is that we have an opportunity to rebuild that we didn't think we would have a year ago. Obviously, tragic circumstances have led to this opportunity, but let's not waste that opportunity. Let's really think about how we can include everyone who wants to be a part of this growth. You know, we may need to take an extra step or two to include some segments of our society, but we should. Everybody, you know, with everyone thinking about what this region should look like, we'll just have better outcomes and a better community.
And when it comes to giving, there's the next few weeks I know are critical in the nonprofit world. I had read that from World Vision, some stats around like three out of five people donate in the last 2 weeks of the year, whether that's for holiday giving or for tax reasons, whatever it is. Now, when people are thinking about how they're giving back this year, I think that they are going to do it in a much larger, more charitable way, because I can see people not traveling for Christmas, wanting to give back to their community. What, in your opinion and your thoughts, like, what is the best way for us to do that and allocate those funds at the end of the year?
There are several things to think about when one gives money. It's certainly what I think about, right? It's one is, you know, you're giving to something that you care about. You know, often people give to things that are both close to home as well as far away, you know, to support things happening elsewhere. So think about what you care about. Think about sustainable impact, you know, and tangibility of your donation. You know, will you be able to see how this is having an impact, whether it's in your community or elsewhere? These, I think, are important. And the sustainable element is really important here, because you want, most people want to give to something that has an immediate impact, but a lasting impact as well. And so I think that's something else to keep in mind. As the Capital Area Food Bank, you know, we're able to do things at scale, and that I think is an important distinctive value proposition of what we offer. We also work with over 400 local community partners, many of whom are, you know, in Northern Virginia, as well as in the community, the Greater Washington community. So when you give to the Capital Area Food Bank, you're also supporting many of your, you know, local nonprofits, if you will. So those are some of the things that I would think about. I would certainly encourage people, you know, food, shelter, those are important things. And as we engage as a food bank, not only in providing food, but supporting with partnerships in these other areas, a donor is able to see the impact in really elevating people out of poverty. Yes, first through food insecurity, but in our partnership through skill development, through education, through healthcare as well.
I think it's just an amazing story that you have to tell, Radha. So we really appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's also just a keen reminder that, you can't start physical therapy before you have surgery, and you need to get people fed before they can focus. And with added focus come results. So I think, again, you look at the long-term impact that you're trying to create. I just applaud you for it. So this is great. And if people want to try to get in touch with you, how would you recommend they do that?
The best way to get in touch with us is through our website, capitalareafoodbank.org. And thank you in advance for our community that supported us in the last several months, in addition to the last several years. And we look forward to continued support to really support those who need it the most at this time.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this episode and subscribe to future episodes on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to give us that 5-star review so that we can get our podcast out to more and more listeners. If you are a business leader or know of any business leaders that you would like to nominate to be a guest on the show, please visit us at thenovabusinesspodcast.com.